Our next speaker is Nathan Hollier. Dr. Nathan Hollier is director of the Monash University Publishing. He has worked in academia and academic publishing since the mid-1990s, including as editor of Overland magazine from 2002 to 2007. He's the founding president and current board member of Spunk Incorporated, and which is the representative body for small and independent publishers in Australia, and a member of the Scholarly Publishing Expert Reference Group of the Federal Government's Book Industry Collaborative Council. Nathan's going to speak today on open access publishing, panacea or problem. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks for inviting me, and Paula as well for inviting me along. And I apologise, I don't have any pictures. I was kind of pleased that Gavin didn't, because I didn't get around to doing it either. I wanted to take the opportunity afforded by having been asked to speak at this forum to get a better grasp of the issues around open access publishing and of the arguments for and against it. In my abstract, I set out this issue of whether open access publishing is good or bad in a fairly open-ended way, as if the jury is still out on this question. Now that I've actually looked into the issue a bit, I don't believe that the jury is out, or should at least be out. Open access scholarly publishing of one kind or another is desirable and should be achievable. I will talk briefly of existing arguments against open access, while noting also the benefits of this model of publishing as I see them. But I'll mainly focus on a question that I think is less clear-cut, or that the answer to it is less clear-cut. That's the question of whether or not there continues to be a value or a compelling argument for scholarly open access publishers publishing into bookstores and or selling rather than giving away ebook content. In answering this question, I'll be discussing the contemporary scholarly publishing sector, especially in Australia, and drawing in part on my own experience as a participant within that sector. I've tried to put on my scholar's or researcher's hat in putting this paper together, but I'm not deluding myself or seeking to delude anyone else that I'm able to be as free of commercial and political pressures as Habermas, amongst others, has stipulated that intellectuals should aspire at least to be. I find dropping the name of a heavy German theorist at times gives more gravity to a fairly basic point. Inevitably, my own interests and business decisions that I've already taken have influenced my perceptions. And one final point to note is that I'm indebted to my tireless and, by me at least, unpaid research assistant, Colin Steele, who, since I was lucky enough to have moved into his email circle, has kept me up to date with new developments, statements, documents and arguments in this field. I was kind of hoping he'd be here today because I saw some correspondence from him where he said he was hoping to be. But open access publishing is good for scholars. It maximises the visibility and evidence suggests even the research impact of research. An open access article is most likely to be used and cited. Open access also enables more timely publication. As they spend most of their scholarly time reading, open access is of course also good for scholars in this sense. An open availability of research encourages, or at least enables, cross-disciplinary thought and engagement. Governments which fund research and much of the infrastructure around it have much to gain, both from that research being made as available as broadly as possible, and from avoiding having to buy research or buy it back from commercial organisations driven for the most part by commercial imperatives. The same basic logic applies to recipients of that government research investment, such as universities and their libraries. Though as universities in Australia especially come under pressure to seek specifically commercial sources of funding, this can encourage them to participate in the commercialisation, which is to say the privatisation of research. It needs also to be acknowledged that there are quite different levels of government funding for research around the world. Australia and New Zealand are at the higher end of that. It's often pointed out that library finances currently being paid in subscriptions could otherwise be spent supporting open access publishing of a gold or even a green variety. This observation lies at the root of the innovative business models advanced by Francis Pinter in recent years. Libraries, needless to say, have been amongst the most active institutional supporters and advocates of open access publishing. And librarians have been at the forefront of attempts to expose and undermine the apparent profiteering of private journal publishing behemoths, Reed, Elsevier and Springer especially. The scholarly publishing, I mentioned Spark, you probably all know about, is one expression of that library interest. And in Australia, the Council of Australian University Libraries has established a subcommittee to represent and coordinate its members' publishing activities, all of which include open access publishing of one kind or another. Members of the general public also benefit from open access publishing in direct and indirect ways. A publishing colleague of mine at a company that hasn't embraced open access yet, at any rate, told me recently of a friend of his whose father was diagnosed had an illness which had made him blind, was advised that this was incurable, did research himself, I don't know how exactly he did it, but because of open access policies was able to find a doctor which gave him hope of restoring his sight, and the doctor subsequently delivered on that promise. Of less immediate but perhaps even more profound public benefit is the increasing availability of scholarship, including whole courses online, through initiatives such as OpenCourseWare at MIT. The public, moreover, pay taxes and, with government, can probably expect to receive better return on their investment in research from an open access publishing environment than from a privatised commercial one based on permissions payments and fee for access. I had thought, at any rate, that this was the logic behind the UK's decision coming out of the Finch report. But in light of Rebecca's paper, where she's saying that they are setting aside extra money and for this gold model, I'm not entirely sure what they're doing. Critics argue that open access publishing is either unnecessary or likely to be harmful to the public good. Most scientific literature, it's contended, is available for researchers via interlibrary loan at the very least, where a researcher's home institution does not itself subscribe to a particular publication. Thus, outgoing Australian Research Council CEO Margaret Scheel stated in April this year, "Information has never been more accessible to the research community than it is now. I just don't believe that argument that the research community can't get access to research." This seems less certain when viewed from an international perspective, which, admittedly, the head of an Australian government research body may be under no compunction to do. In poorer countries, access to information and the communication technology that makes it available is more scarce and expensive in relative terms, facts which have underpinned the development of open source publishing software, such as that of the Public Knowledge Project based in Canada. One would also have to wonder if it is the best use of a nation's resources to have 20 libraries in research institutions subscribing individually to the same journals, where the cost of electronic delivery, as opposed to capital investment or fixed costs, are so low. Open access publishing has been criticised by journal publishers, especially as constituting unwarranted government intrusion into private commercial activity and as deadening through this individual initiative and entrepreneurialism. These seem to me rather fundamentalist arguments that aren't based on strong evidence, but there are some more testing questions in relation to open access publishing. Perhaps the likelihood that commercial companies like pharmaceutical manufacturers will spend less on paying for others' research in an open access world while being no more likely to share their research. Perhaps that's a second-order issue when viewed alongside the benefits and savings from open access. And it may not matter greatly that research-intensive institutions in a gold open access environment especially might end up paying more for journal publication than they did previously, while teaching-focused institutions pay less, especially since research publication also yields payment from government research funding bodies. But what will be the effect of mandatory open access publishing policies on the great many not-for-profit journals or not-for-profit journal publishing associations? Will they be able to adjust their business models and attain sufficient revenue to do all that they currently do without charging a journal subscription fee? These are conversations that I've had a number of times with the people involved with the two journals that we publish. So far, an ideal solution hasn't materialised, although I would guess that if government legislated that the research it funds should be published in an institutional repository within, say, 2 years, and this was built into contracts between authors and journal publishing associations, this would not significantly affect the financial viability of those associations. Such legislation would be likely to affect the profitability of commercial journal publishing operations, but that seems an acceptable price for government and society to pay. Scheel has stated there are many, many examples of where protecting intellectual property actually makes it more readily available because then someone is prepared to commercialise it and make it accessible. This is easy to imagine, though I wonder if such problems could not also be sorted out legislatively by, for example, stipulating that certain published research can only be commercially developed by the company with whom its author has a contract. Often a student will publish his or her PhD in a repository, for instance, but still obtain a contract for the thesis to be turned into a book. If the publisher is adding value to the work through the editing process, design and packaging, marketing and so on, the published original version of the research is not likely to be a significant financial factor. It's only if the publisher is not adding genuine value to the work that the financial value of that work might be at all likely to be compromised by its being available open access in its original form. I wonder if the same would not hold true for other forms of intellectual output, but I haven't really thought it through, so I'm not sure. Writing in Research Fortnight publication in July this year, Peter Webster has argued that as humanities scholars by and large do not need large capital equipment and facilities beyond a good library, scholars outside universities, in museums, libraries, archives, across the professions and not least among the retired, regularly publish world-leading research. Universal gold open access funded by the author would wipe much of this out. This seems to me a strong argument against gold open access funding models, which to me only points to the superiority of green open access. And as Rebecca has mentioned, the payment to publish model, the gold model, is now being taken up quite enthusiastically by Elsevier and Springer because as these firms recognise, a payment to them of around 15,000 euros a book prior to its publication is not a bad revenue stream. As noted earlier, in relation to possible open access policies that would be compatible with not-for-profit journal publishing, legislation that would require government-funded research to be published in institutional repositories would be unlikely to adversely affect these not-for-profit journal publishers and wouldn't affect independent scholars either. More troublingly for me, Webster also argued, so far there is little sign of an open access business model for book publishing. Mostly this was troubling for me because I thought we'd established such a model and had been publishing with that model since the launch of our business in September 2010. When we put our model together, we were influenced most strongly by the example of ANU ePress, which since 2003 has published over 400 titles, including some journals, open access. University of Adelaide Press also looked to the ANU ePress in developing its model. Since its establishment in 2009, it's published over 20 books. Monash University Publishing, launching in September 2010, is now publishing around 20 books a year, a bit more. These three Australian university presses, each based physically or administratively in the library of its host institution, have developed successful open access business, book publishing business models, and a number of other Australian university libraries are planning to enter this open access book publishing environment. Sydney University Press does also some open access publishing, and the university itself, Sydney Uni, has an open access policy. Of these presses, Monash University Publishing is the only one that distributes its titles actively into bookstores via professional distributors operating around the world. So I will admit to an element of the rhetorical when I ask whether it's worth open access scholarly publishers publishing into bookstores and or selling rather than giving away ebook content. clearly we do think it's worth doing this. In reaching this decision to operate as an open access scholarly publisher in the commercial realm and to face the very considerable financial and administrative pressures that that entails, a number of considerations came into play. Could we produce books that looked good enough, which is to say were individualised enough to go into bookstores and attract readers at a cost-effective price? What did our readers want? How important was design to them? And would they buy print versions of our books if they are available online, open access? If so, would they prefer to buy them from bookstores, which means paying a bit more for them, sometimes quite a bit more for them, or would they simply prefer to buy them from our site or from another online channel? Is professional distribution important to book reviewers and to review organs from broadsheets and popular magazines and journals of review to specialist journals, many of which are online? Is this kind of distribution important to prize committees? Does that print revenue stream matter in the context of herdic payments? What did our authors want? What did our host institution want? As you can imagine, rather an important question. Most fundamentally, we were driven by a desire to maximise the cultural impact of our titles, and this has been written into our charter, partly on the basis of the belief that cultural standing will, in time, lead to economic standing, or put another way, that a prestigious brand will translate in a positive way to sales and sales revenue, which, of course, is also affected by price. We thought that for the moment at least, it is worth individually designing books, selling them into bookstores and marketing them in traditional as well as new online ways, that all of this is necessary at this point in time to maximise the cultural impact and standing of the press and its titles to stand properly within or at the centre of the Australian public sphere. The example of the ANU ePress, which was selling print versions of its titles in the thousands across its list, even though they were being made simultaneously available online in PDF, encourage us to think that that there was room for print and electronic versions. This was backed up by the experience of Repress, a Melbourne-based publisher of philosophy, and the publisher there wrote on his site, "We do not consider the digital version a replacement for the physical book. On the contrary, we believe that the two mediums perform different functions, offering the best of both worlds. In fact, it is our hope that open access publishing will strengthen traditional publishing and scholarship more broadly." Not all of our titles, I must note, are available open access. Some of the more commercial titles we have deliberately delayed online publication of, and we've tried to be flexible and accommodate authors that for one reason or another, which is often an emotional reason, don't want their books available online for free. We also don't put PDFs online, unlike the ANU ePress, the Adelaide University Press and Repress. In this, we publish online in HTML and EPUB format, so you can download it to an e-reader as well. In this, we followed the example of the National Academies Press, publisher for the National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine and other arms of the National Academies in the US, which has found that these formats, at least, promote print book sales. We were conscious of not wanting to cannibalise print sales, and our distributors and booksellers wouldn't have been happy if we were putting PDF versions up online. And we're also of the view that publishing PDFs online makes piracy just too easy. Nonetheless, we are hopeful that through open access electronic publishing, in conjunction with print publishing and professional distribution, we'll not only be maximising cultural impact, but visibility, readership and the exchange of knowledge. Former politics professor at my alma mater, which is Monash, said that in politics, victory is the great legitimator. And I suppose in business, revenue is the great legitimator. So I'm pleased to report that the business model of Monash University Publishing does appear to be working. We are on track to hit our revenue and other budget targets for this year. And we're also pleased with the media attention that our works have got. A double page spread in The Australian for one of our titles. The highly scientific marketing concept of advertising value equivalency is now one of my best friends, because I can't necessarily point to millions of dollars coming in, but I say, look at this, this is the equivalency, according to this concept, of a lot of money. I can't remember what it is. Well, it's basically, it's three times the cost of advertising. So if you ever, I did the calculation on a single page in The Australian costs about $20,000 to advertise. So of course I bring this to the university and say, I'm bringing in this in-kind income. But as I mentioned at the outset, I'm not exactly an unbiased voice, so I won't go on pumping up my own tyres. The point is that open access publishing is very far from a problem. In my view, it's possible and indeed desirable to combine the public benefits of open access publishing, thinking especially of green open access publishing, with the essentially private benefits of commercial publishing, and not just in relation to journals and the hard sciences, but books and the social sciences and humanities also, because scholarly and trade, print and e-books are all different things.